happening, Garrett?
Hey, Sean, it's Garrett. Yeah, I just want to talk about a media bias that's kind of driving me, or it's been on the radio that's driving me nuts. This band called System of a Down. They're a band I used to like, and actually I used to kind of follow, and when I was younger, and now like they got this song out called BYOB, Bring Your Own Bomb. And the song is just very hateful, and it's just hateful to...
What group is this?
System of a Down.
I don't know who they are, I'll be honest. I'm a country music fan.
Well, what do I know?
I listen
to country stuff, too. I listen to rock, too. I listen to all different kinds of music. I mean, but, you know, and the thing that's bad about it is I can't really... You know, I don't even want to listen to rock stations anymore because it just makes me sick. And
I'm surprised a lot of stations would play that.
Well, and a lot, like one part of the song goes, "F the fascist nation." It's just so hateful, and they say we live in this horrible fascist nation, and
I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm writing this down now, and when I get back on Tuesday, I'm going to see if I get a hold of this thing, and maybe we can make a stink about it. Okay.
And another thing that they say, there's a couple things. Bring your, they say
you little punk wimp. You won't have to worry about a System of the Down bringing some bombs your way. This is the real stuff coming at you. And Sean Hannity, you little punk, if you're so disturbed by this group, as you indicated, why don't you just have them on your show and debate them on this subject matter? Why are they against U.S. imperialism? Why are they against this imperialist war? What problems do they have with the U.S. empire? You have your own show. You're a big corporate media guy. Why don't you just challenge them? Why don't you critique their words, what they say? Because you're a little cowardly punk. And you want to go through your little Clear Channel collaborators, the Fuhrer style, to excommunicate them off the air, if possible. So what's more hateful? A punk that talks about free speech in the land of the free, but practices censorship. Get the hell out of here. Here's a response to your censorship, slave revolt. Check it out. Listening to 101.1 Freak Radio out of Santa Cruz with Super Skid Mark, 106.7 Illinois, LUVER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe. You click in on your Google web, Slave Revolt Radio, to find out what time it is on the Slave blog. Tonight, we're going to explore an experience that happened in the past in a number of occasions with the industrialists, and that you can see taking place today. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
Seekers everywhere, I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see where they've gone? They're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure what the amount of energy that's
beyond the shadow. And tonight, what we're going to deal with is, as each day goes by on Sam's plantation, it has been beyond clear how the U.S. Empire is shoring up its corporate totalitarian state structure. Now, this is a critical issue for us slaves in revolt, for how and when we respond, how fierce and unified our response is, and how well developed our analysis is on these savages' evolutionary stage development in their totalitarian order as capitalism is finding itself more and more crisis is an issue of life and death. We're going to examine in part a book and its author called Henry Ford and the Jews. It's a book written by Neil Baldwin as part of a collective understanding. Now, this is just one part of the episode. There are many elements to the corporate backing of Hitler. You know, we have IBM, we have GE, so on and so forth. There's no way that on one particular show, all of these particular elements can be covered, you know, in an hour or so. So it'll just be like an ongoing series of understanding the situation that we find ourselves in and the developing apparatus, the historical and living experience in this corporate Fuhrer order. Now first, let's listen to how Neil Baldwin explains Henry's moral code towards his employee to see how old Henry dealt in various ways with his employees to get an understanding of the complexity of those who align themselves with totalitarian states. Check this out.
Ford had a very paternal, on the surface, Ford's behavior as a captain of industry, I found very appealing when I first got into it. He had he raised the hourly wage, the daily wage for workers in his factory to an unprecedented $5 a day at a time when most American workers were making half the amount or less. He provided housing for his workers. He absolutely did hire immigrants and people from other cultures to work in his factories. However, he had a very strict and very rigorous and very invasive Americanization program. He actually sponsored an Americanization school. So, indeed, you could be a Jew and be hired by Henry Ford. However, you would be forced to take classes in not only English language, but etiquette, behavior. You would have to dress in a certain way. You would have to agree to certain rules in the way that you lived, in the way you conducted your life. No boarders could be taken into your home. Married men were preferred over the unmarried because supposedly their moral fiber was stronger. And so there's two sides to every story, and I think Ford probably decided that if you were going to be a Jew and work for him, then you'd have to conform to his very rigorous moral standards.
All right, so you can get an indication of how sick this individual was, Henry, but also how very similar these particular types of codes of conduct resonate within those within this type of society. You often hear many of the right wing go on and on about how they believe in order, a certain type of order, English only, you know, so he has clashes in English, how to behave, quote unquote. He preferred married men. This is because of he felt they had, quote unquote, a higher moral type code and stuff. Now, that's the same type of rhetoric that you hear the Christian right and those in who back them and those who they back pushing out, because it's all about controlling individuals and putting them into a little straight jacket. All of this dress a certain way and proper etiquette, so on and so forth. Now, keep this in the same context of someone who found himself goose-stepping with Adolf. Now, many people within this particular society and throughout the world glorify these people who are called captains of industry, because they're seen as individuals who have a high type of uniqueness, a high type of strength, moral code, independence, iron will. They're men of stature that know how to tame the West. You know, all of these types of things that they throw on these types of industrialists to play them as larger-than-life type characters. And then when they construct these images about them, the common working person is supposed to only just bow down in their presence. After all, they're the captains of industry. They know how to get things done, make societies work, etc., etc. So they, of course, outline these very restrictive types of ways of hemming in your lives. They want to control how much you make. They want to set the tables of whether or not you get health care, 40-hour work week, get the hell out of here. They want to put your kids into these slave labor camps, etc., etc., and you're supposed to just stand in awe to these industrialists for being in their particular presence. Meanwhile, these same individuals are goose-stepping along with the most totalitarian and barbaric regimes on the planet. So they have no... What kind of etiquette is that? What kind of proper behavior, quote-unquote, is that? What kind of moral code is that? But if you fall for the type of false history that the capitalist story likes to promote, then you can be suspect to what this imagery is trying to lay out.
That's right. Now, talking about history, one of his most famous quotes from Mr. Ford himself is that history is bunk. That's what Henry Ford said. Why? Well, he may want you to take etiquette, but he doesn't want you to learn about the history of the working people and understand where you stand in this world. You see, because actually he was virulently anti-union. This cat did not in any way want to see the workers organize themselves and worked day and night to keep the unions out of his facilities, or the facilities that he owned. Now, you should also know, this is a fact, Ford actually received an award from Hitler. It was called the Iron Cross. And this is before the United States actually entered the war. Remember, the United States didn't declare war against Germany until 1941. But all during the 30s, Ford was in direct contact with, doing business with, and helping Hitler after Hitler's rise to power. After he came to power, Hitler came to power in 1933 in Germany and received, as I said, the Iron Cross, which was a national medal of honor from Hitler.
It was an honor that they gave to foreigners. It was the highest honor. There's a poem that was that ran in the in-house magazine for, published by Ford Motor Company, Germany subsidiary, in April of 1940. It was titled Führer. And at the time, O. Henry maintained complete control of this German company. The poem went, quote, "We have sworn to you once, but now we make our allegiance permanent. Like currents in a torrent lost, we all flow into you. Even when we cannot understand you, we will go with you. One day we may comprehend how you can see our future. Hearts like bronze shields we have placed around you, and it seems to us that only you can reveal God's world to us." Now, that sounds like some Ash Call for Boy George type stuff. Throwing in God and pledging allegiance without understanding. Now, take a look at this war that took place. And it's taking place. A lot of it was based off of trust. In other words, it was clear that Boy George, Colin Cancer Powell, Rumsfeld, on and on and on, really didn't have a real strong, solid leg concerning the weapons of mass destruction. But just like little Eichmann's, the corporate media and large segment of the Gumpified population went along in a way that would have made the writers of this poem in the 1940s proud. "Even when we cannot understand you, we will go with you. One day we may comprehend how you can see our future. Sig Heil, Boy George. Lead us off against against the brown terrorists." Now next, Baldwin goes into more of Henry Ford's sociological codes of behavior and methods. So let's see what he has to say. Check this out.
Say you were working for Ford, you'd have to be ready to see one of these members of the sociological department could end up on your doorstep at any time of the day or night to sort of check up on you, make sure that you were sticking to the straight and narrow path. He also had questionnaires and exams that he would administer to his workers, asking them very basic facts of American history, which is interesting considering that one of Ford's most famous homilies is "History is more or less the bunk." However, he didn't always practice what he preached, and he had a very, very strong jingoistic streak. I think that also fed into his Jew bias, because he had a lot of trouble associating with people who he felt were different in any way. And it was very hard if you were associated with Ford, you socialized with him, and you would go to his home after dinner. It was very hard to avoid being drawn into an anti-Semitic conversation.
All right, once again, see, you're getting into some of the mindset, not of the workers, of Ford. This is a sick little, close to being a psychopath type of individual. Now, here you have a sociological department with questionnaires of its employees. So in other words, it's not good enough if you're just doing your job, you're a decent employee, doing your work, et cetera, et cetera. He wants to get up all into your business and stuff. This is how Henry and company wanted to operate and did operate. See, there's something fundamentally wrong going on here when you see that type of stuff take place. But at the same time, you know, when Henry was talking about history is more or less debunked. Now, first of all, it's clear that this is something very self-absorbing and self-serving coming from a little capitalist, because at the same time, this individual is putting out publications through his little Dearborn paper that he purchased, and books, International Jew and stuff like that, which tried to give, quote-unquote, a historical understanding of how Jews, as financiers and bankers, were trying to basically take over the world. So if he really believed that, quote-unquote, history was bunk, why would he invest so much time into going into all of this myth type of stuff and anti-Jewish type of writings and stuff? Because him as a capitalist doesn't believe that history is bunk. He believes that history that goes outside of the parameters of the ruling class is bunk. That they should be the dominant writers of history. That they should be the ones in the forefront of creating the story of how history is outlined and should be understood. This is where old Adolf Henry was coming from.
Wow, you know, he developed a strange, he liked to push that religion thing too. I'm talking about general Christianity. Now I wonder, I don't know if he himself was religious, but he promoted that. And in fact, he had established a relationship with a lot of black churches in Detroit, because that was the way to get hired at Ford. If you went to certain churches where the preacher knew Ford, you go to that church and then you can get on. See, and this is one of the tools that he used to prevent Ford Motors from becoming union. So understand, there's a method to all of this madness. That it wasn't just myth. In reality, he did what he could to keep his workers disorganized.
When I say myth, I'm talking about the myth that he's creating and others like him create, that following under the capitalist order is a way of progress, is a way of democracy, is a way of humanitarianism, etc., etc. Not unlike what Boy George and them are trying to push out today. Their story of freedom and independence is in part based off of a mythical story that they write. Not too much different than the slaveocracy after the defeat of the Reconstruction period, mythologically created a whole fanciful story about what took place in the South during the Reconstruction period, which gave one the impression that the Negroes were running amok and shooting down the poor white folks and raping them and pillaging the land. And it wasn't until white folks who were on their knees cringing at the horror of the Zip Coons and others that they finally rose up in their own self-defense and their own genetic code of justice to put the Negroes back in place. It was a mythical story, something that still seems to resonate today, like many other things. But the reason why I mentioned the myth type of stuff is that at the same time, let's transport ourselves up to what's going on today. We see these dogs talk about the freedoms that people in this country have that you don't see other places. And this is part of the reasons why they tell us that we should stay the course. Even when we go through quote-unquote rocky times, you know, gas skying out of the ceiling, schools crumbling, prison industrial complex exploding, healthcare dropping down to the center of the earth. Behold the course, because we have some of our freedoms, you know. That's what Boy George and the rulers are quote-unquote trying to protect. Yet at the same time, once again, Congress passes another thing, which of course is consolidating their power in a more totalitarian type way. This one is the Real ID Act. Now, the effect will be profound in the transformation in people's lives in this country and those who are trying to and do enter in. Driver's license will basically be transformed into identity cards. Any states that refuse to accept these and absorb the cost of going into this national ID type system, then the people of those states wouldn't be able to board airplanes or enter federal buildings without some kind of approved card. And it may be impossible to even open a bank account or collect security Social Security payments. This is how they're responding. Now, the final bill passed 368-58. In the Senate, it passed unanimously. All right, that's it. No more. Look, we've already beat this down before. All arguments concerning lesser of two evils. Now, the next time a punk jumps up talking this Democrat stuff, it may have to get physical at this point. Because we're running out of time. And we don't have time to play no more games with these clowns who, in the final hour, are still whistling in the dark and talking about, you know, Barbara Lee will save the day or some nonsense like that. You have a situation also where what they did, and this is part of the reason also that I'm mentioning this, was that they slyly put this in and attached it to the $82 billion earmark for the U.S. Imperialist occupation. So it was tagged the Emergency Supplemental Appropriation Act for Defense, the Global War on Terror, and the Tsunami Relief Act of 2005. So they knew that then it would be more easy for the Congress and the Senate to go ahead and sign it, you know, without looking over their shoulders too much by some of their population who are saying, what are you doing? But what this does, though, it integrates in this whole war on terror with, quote unquote, protection of the fatherland. So, once again, it helps prove that militarism abroad cannot be separated for how democratic rights are undermined in this country and how the state apparatus, the corporate state apparatus, becomes more and more emboldened and invigorated and seizes the time to try to seize more of our rights in these times of artificial crises that they create. Now, it's a real crisis for the Iraqi people and for the globe on one sense. The reason why I say artificial is because it's something that is being artificially manufactured by the imperialists. Now, next, Baldwin goes into some of Henry's ties with the German state. So let's see how that plays itself out. Check this out.
Hitler sent an emissary to America in the early years before he had even ascended to full power of the Reich. He sent an emissary to this country named Kurt Ludeke, a fundraiser, essentially a fundraiser for the Reich. And he instructed him to be sure and pay a call on Henry Ford. This was in the early 1920s. And Ludeke came to Detroit, and he was able to get a private meeting with Henry Ford. And Ford denied, subsequent to that, that he ever gave funding directly to Nazi Germany or to Adolf Hitler. I think that Ford's support of Hitler is ideological rather than financial. In my research, I was not able to uncover any paper trail directly leading to Hitler from Ford with a financial edge to it. Now, that being said, Henry Ford knew very early on that Germany was a rich, could be a rich potential source for his company. In 1924 and 1925, he already had a factory in place in Berlin and was producing cars over there. And about 5 or 6 years later, the major Ford plant in Cologne was in operation. And there's no question that for about 15-year period there, Fords were a popular brand in Germany leading up to World War II. That, and again, I must qualify that by saying that many American companies were participating in the economy of Germany at that time. And it's ironic because General Motors actually had a much larger share of the market for the first decade or so that the car companies were, American car companies had a presence in Germany. Starting in the earliest years of World War II, however, Ford began to produce materiel and trucks and jeeps and vehicles of a more useful nature to the Germans.
Actually, the United States, strangely enough, did get off into the auto industry early on. But it's important to note that Germany did start their own production. In fact, the Volkswagen came from, you know, that was a brainchild of the Hitler regime to have this, you know, vehicle that was available to everyone, a populist type of a push to satisfy people's consumer needs. But what really matters here is not just how many cars were sold here and there, who developed what car, but yes, there was an ideological kinship between Ford and Hitler. You see, reactionary, what is fascism but the distillation of the most reactionary elements of bourgeois ideology? That's what fascism is. And therefore, there was a kind of an eye-to-eye thing going on between Ford and Hitler. It's not surprising.
You know, this guy's kind of soft-pedaling it on some of the ties in his talk. But, you know, what's kind of interesting is that, you know, when Henry put out his pamphlet, The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem, it caught the attention of Adolf. Now, this was in 1923. And Hitler told the Chicago Tribune that, quote, "I wish that I could send some of my shock troops to Chicago and other big American cities to help," unquote. So he was talking about his shock troops helping people like Henry deal with the labor struggles going on. So this is this eye-to-eye type of alliance. Keep the masses down. Keep the masses in their place. Kind of like that whole behavior modification type stuff that we went into earlier that Henry was doing in his workplace. At the same time, you know about how the Reich had this kind of follow the leader. The leader knows all. Then you see it take place within the poems that were being outlined by Ford's plant. Now, in Adolf's Mein Kampf, you know, the book that he wrote a couple of years later, in that book, Adolf outlines his admiration for Ford and says, quote, "It is Jews who govern the stock exchange forces of the American Union. Every year makes them more and more the controlling masters of the producers in a nation of 120 million. Only a single great man, Ford, to their fury, still maintains full independence," unquote. So here you see, right in Mein Kampf, Adolf praising, straight up praising Henry Ford, and actually had a big photo of him and had all the pamphlets and publications that Henry was releasing once he got hold of his own little printing paper and stuff. Now, what's also interesting is that you have a situation where when the Nazis did seize power and start to stomp into other areas, Ford vehicles, which Henry still had control over. It wasn't like they just seized them and he no longer had control. He was working and making profit and in collaboration with them. Now, the Ford vehicles were crucial to the Nazi military strategy of Blitzkrieg. 350,000 trucks were used by the motorized German army in 1942. A third of them were Ford made. So this was after, this was beyond after. It was clear before what Adolf and company were up to. Look, the industrialists saw Adolf as a cure-all for the crisis that the capitalists found themselves in Germany. The economic crisis as a result of, in part, World War I, the type of situation that they found themselves paying back other countries, other capitalist countries, you know. The working class growing in vitality. There was concern throughout the privatized, industrialized world that if Germany fell left, the crisis that that would have on their capitalist world order overall. Hitler, they saw as part of the antidote to that. So this is in part why you saw the backing of Hitler by General Electric, Ford, IBM, etc., etc., etc. So you see an ideological link that's tied to an economic factor that helps them justify their overall goals and reaching.
And when the international bourgeoisie staked their last card on this fascist and on the victory of these fascists, they were forced to toboggan with their eyes closed towards military catastrophe. Because when the thing actually broke down, what did Hitler really do? He attacked Russia. When World War II broke out, people should never forget, 25 million Russians died in that war. And Hitler lost most of his forces in Russia. He had conquered much of Europe. France capitulated. He went all through Europe, victory after victory after victory. But when he went into Russia, it was a different story. It's a great film on Stalingrad called The Gates, right?
Enemy at the Gates.
Enemy at the Gates. Thank you very much, Trace. But, you know, Hitler did come here, though, Trace. Not physically in that sense. But you know how he came, away he came? There were groups in America that were modeled upon Hitler. And they were, some of them were active in Detroit.
American Nazi Party.
The Silver Shirts. These were hardcore shock troops that attacked the workers at their picket lines. Workers didn't know what to do for a minute, but they got it together. And once they began to understand that their continued existence and the growth of these fascist bands were mutually exclusive, I will say that our fellow workers did a good job in smashing this fascist threat right here in the United States.
Now, a more developed understanding would have had them continue on and smash the capitalists, because they were just as fascistic. And as Smedley Butler, the legendary Brigadier General, found out in a legendary book called The Plot to Seize the White House, outlined by Jules Archer, the fascists in America, J.P. Morgan and others, decided they wanted hear what they had going on in Mussolini's town and old Adolf's town. So they approached Brigadier General, the Brigadier General, and asked him, Smedley Butler, and asked him to lead the seizing of the White House. Have 500, they give him 500,000 troops, and that he would, you know, more or less clean house. They would capture Roosevelt, and if Roosevelt went along, all good. If he didn't, well, you know, hey, you know, Chavez, Venezuela, you listening? You know, so this is what they took place. Smedley turned on him,
right,
and came out with it about what was going. The plot exposed it all. And a lot of it was, you know, kind of in traditional American fashion, drained down the memory hole. You know, the Americana population is excellent at things that are disturbing to the mythological belief systems about the state order in this country. Find your way draining out of the memory hole. But there was investigations, not only by those who are part of the state, which they did and had to admit that this plot was real, but by other researchers and Smedley's own work himself. This blew it all out. My whole point in part in mentioning this is that it's clear that these dogs, these savages, have no respect for the masses of working class people. They are state controllers, corporate state plunderers, and smashing the world into their order is their mindset. Now, next, Baldwin outlines what Ford next did to get out of get out his wholesome all-American views. So let's see what that was. Check it out.
The Dearborn Independent was a tiny little country newspaper in Dearbornville, Michigan, and Henry Ford decided that he needed a platform for his views. And he hired very, very top editorial talent from the Detroit News to help edit and run the magazine, run the newspaper, and began to publish a weekly paper. The first 6 months of the Dearborn Independent were very lively. It was kind of like an all-purpose, feature-oriented publication. There were articles about women's issues, and there was poetry in the newspaper. There was articles from overseas, photo spreads, all kinds of interesting things. But starting about 6 months into the newspaper, the tenor changed, and Ford began to use it as a platform for his anti-Semitic views, and he published over the next 2 years, 1920 through 1922, he published an article every single week vilifying the Jewish people in one way or another. So he proceeded to transform the newspaper from an all-around weekly news sheet into an anti-Semitic screed.
All right, now, let's wake up to what's going on. These fools are recycling stuff. Now, transport this type of a technique. Henry's war, basically, that's what it was, on the Jews. It was just a pretext. Today, what the capitalists do is their war, quote-unquote, is on terrorism. So they use, in part, one of their elements that they aim at to have this fear factor that they pound away with the Hannity and Cone show, with the Bill O'Reilly, Limbaugh, Michael Savage, et cetera, et cetera. They pound on the other Semitic group, the Arabs. So there, you could put them in a place of what Henry was doing, and they continuously pound. At the same time, though, you have a situation where they have an ongoing war prophesizing mechanism going on against another so-called terrorist group. This is the narco-terrorists. Now, that's code word for Latin Americans. So this justifies another war that they continuously have. That goes on in Latin America. So they constantly are bashing away, trying to overthrow governments like in Venezuela, attacking Fidel, etc., etc., justifying the overthrow of Aristide in Haiti, constantly pounding the threat, so on and so forth. So if they become somewhat organized and outwardly anti-capitalist, then they say they're narco-Maoist terrorists. Whether they're Maoist or not, it doesn't matter. They're just using it for, you know, terminology on a gumpified American population. So then that justifies more onslaught by the empire and so on and so forth. Now, in Africa, they use another form of fighting their war on the various terrorist groups. But there, they call them dictatorships or warlords. So we see that take place in countries throughout Africa that are no longer under Sam's complete control, in areas like Angola or Somalia, so on and so forth. Now, at the same time, this is all had historically been under the umbrella of another war that was continuously happening, the Cold War War with the Soviets. That's played itself out now, but at the time, that would continue to go on and on. War, 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 threat, threat, threat. And then, of course, at home, you have the continuous ultimate threat in many ways, which takes place in the war on drugs, the war on crime, the war on guns, which, of course, is the war on black, the Negro problem, the thing that has been their greatest way of dividing the working class in this country. The Republicans and Democrats are able to play the good beast, bad beast scenario amongst themselves. White racism and supremacy blinds many white working class people on the class-based exploitation through many of these elements and how they play up the black threat, the Arab threat, especially the black threat in historical terms, so on and so forth, and what's going on within this country. Recently, the cops in L.A. and other places have gotten the term gangs as domestic terrorists and said that they're greater terrorists to the average American citizen than Al-Qaeda could ever be, et cetera, et cetera. So you have this type of mechanism constantly going on that's right within the annals of what Henry has historically done. So now you have a situation where the whole world has been turned into a giant Indian reservation, where you have hostile natives on their Indian plantation reservations getting upset, just like the original disposable people, the natives, were. So we have a situation where fear in the Americana majority population's heart, on a global level, not just national level, has taken place, where you see people in constant fear of how Henry's mindset and tried to lay out was, we need a war on immigration, the immigrants are coming, you know. Then 9/11 happens, and it blows the heads off of many, not all, of course, but many Americanos, and then it justifies, it gives justification from their order of view of the corporate state to Negrofy the whole world. So now it's basically a crisis situation where it should be seen more astutely as a crisis in capitalism, and a war should be more succinctly based on a class war against the capitalists. The capitalists are waging a war on the planet, all in the name of this global war on terrorism and all of its various mechanisms that you see playing out.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, it's always been a tool, war on poverty, you know, war, a warring on everything. But it, Tracy's quite right, it's not simply rhetorical. It does have, there are actual programs of action behind these declarations. And I tell you, the tide is turning against them a little bit. We just seen the American workers, or here in California, they're calling Governor Schwarzenegger the CEO of California. That's what they were calling him at the demonstration Wednesday. So the workers are beginning to see that war is being waged against them in the most basic ways, and are beginning to respond, which is good. We see over and over again this type of, you know, developing consciousness of who's at war against whom.
And its ramifications. Now, what's interesting is, check out how these savages acted during capitalist war that they started. You have a situation where there were quite naturally labor shortages all over the capitalist world as they engaged a good portion of their young male populations into war. Of course, we've seen what happened in this country, but of course it took place in places like Germany, you know, where you had millions of their young men on the front line of the Nazi stormtroopers. So, and then Nazi ideology didn't like the fact of women being in the workplace. You know, this super Aryan stuff wanted women, you know, in the kitchen and all of that type of stuff, similar to, you know, the conservative capitalist model in America. So what ended up happening, though, was German companies started to bid in for forced laborers to keep their production quotas and to maintain and increase profits. So by 1943, half of Ford Work, ended up changing the name to Ford Work, you know, Aryan sounding and all of that. Ford Work workforce comprised of foreign captives. These were captives. These included French people, Russian, Ukrainians, Belgians. In August of 1944, a squad of SS men brought 15 prisoners from the Buchenwald concentration camp to Ford's plant. Now, Henry was still, he was still in the mix. It was never taken out of his control. He still was the captain of that industry because he never turned. He was still operating with them. So here you have a situation where these people were given working 12 hours a day, 15-minute break. They were given 200 grams of bread and coffee for breakfast, no lunch, and for dinner, spinach and three potatoes, and a soup made up of turnip leaves. They were on starvation rations. This is slave labor. Henry was right down with the mix. This is who we're dealing with. These are savages for the order. Now, last, Baldwin outlines what Ford did with his anti-Jewish paper, back pamphlet, and its impact. So let's explore that.
What happened was the articles in the Dearborn Independent, as I say, there were almost 100 of them, and starting in the fall of 1920, Ford began to anthologize these articles into four separate pamphlets. Each one had about 20, 25 articles in it. The pamphlets were called, had the overall headline of The International Jew, the World's Foremost Problem. And there were four of these little paperbacks, and they came out, you know, like every half a year over the ensuing couple of years that the articles were being printed in the Independent, so that if you missed any of them or if your subscription ran out, there were plenty of copies around. And what happened then was that the earliest publication, 1920, 1921, they found their way over to Germany, and they were published by Theodor Fritsch, who was a virulent anti-Semite in very early 20s, translated them into German, and they went through 21 printings in 1921 and 1922 alone. They took off like wildfire in Germany, in Munich especially. If you were a visitor to Adolf Hitler's office in Munich, in the waiting room of Hitler's office, on a sort of low coffee table, was a sort of a display, like spread out, kind of fanned out across the table of the international Jew in the German versions, all the different, pamphlets in a nice display so you could read them while you were waiting to see Hitler. And then when you were finally welcomed into the inner office, you would find a portrait of Henry Ford on the wall behind Hitler's desk. And this is 1922. This is 16 years before Kristallnacht, just to put that in historic perspective. Hitler was a very strong admirer of Henry Ford's ideology. He, in Mein Kampf, he specifically gives credit and admiration to Henry Ford as being the only American. He says there was only one great American, Ford, who understands what we are trying to do here in Germany.
Damn!
Well, I see, don't y'all never say, ever, that we picking on these capitalists unfairly. Because this dude that's talking here, this is no socialist here. He's just a researcher, a book writer, and he just followed the logic of his research. But understand, most importantly, is there such a thing? What is it that in order to break up the extended family, the way we used to look after each other, what did the bourgeoisie push? The nuclear family. Everybody out there on their own, mother, father, and the kids. Individualism. See, this is that bourgeois ideology. Now, it has a dark side. And this propaganda against the Jews did not start yesterday. Remember, the Jews were run out of almost every country in Europe. They were run out of France. They were run out of Spain. Literally, as a group. Run out of the country. So anti-Semitism has a long and sordid history. In Russia, where there were a lot of Jews, there used to be a group that was the rough equivalent of the Ku Klux Klan. It was called the Black Hundreds. And periodically, they would just go out and attack Jewish villages and just kill them. They called it a pogrom. For North, just to do it. And unfortunately, this stuff... The secret police, the Okhrana of the Tsar, wrote a pamphlet that is called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And this pamphlet became the basis of anti-Semitism. It is that pamphlet that Ford's writings were based on. So this, talking about history is bunk, that's because you don't want the workers to go back and see the history themselves. So that they can clearly understand where this capitalist beast was coming from.
What's also interesting is that, at the Ford Work plant, controlled basically by Henry and Company, but it was the work plant in Germany. There was enthusiastic and political support for Hitler. The ties was enormous between Ford and the Nazis. And during Adolf's birthday, the company gave a gift to the Führer of 35,000 Reichsmark. This was in April of 1939. On Hitler's 51st birthday, there was a speech by Hitler under a paper or under his picture. And this is what it said. Quote, "By natural law of earth, we are the supreme race and thus destined to rule." He also stated that communism was, quote, "second in wretchedness only to Judaism," unquote. So Hitler's ideology and Ford's ideology and how it meshed together becomes clearer and clearer. Now, if one looks at the bell curve in America, that book that was written, it basically had black people at the bottom of the intellectual chain of quote-unquote humans. One can see once again this continuous fascination with targeting certain people as the inferior breed. Many people look at what went on in the Nazi land in Germany as an ideology that came from Germany to America. But in actuality, many of them took roots here and went the other way around.
Absolutely.
The whole concept of the genetic inferiority breed was rooted in slavery when certain slave owners, or at least their pseudoscientists, decided that certain slaves that resisted slavery were harboring a genetic malfunction called draptiomania, and that these slaves who were resisting slavery had some kind of genetic disposition that needed and called for them to be isolated from the other inferior breed. So this type of stuff was taking place, and ideology was taking place in Sam's land as a justification of capital expansion for an elite class before Hitler was even born. So you see how this ideology breathes itself in this whole privatized ownership type of mentality. They have to rationalize their exploitation of other human beings. Now, what you see often in their little, like, there's a History Channel show, and they love going on and on about World War II. I mean, they must spend 80% of their time talking, but they'll talk about individual fights and aircraft and strategies of generals, but you don't see them break down the class collaboration of the Henry Fords, the J.P. Morgans, the General Electrics of the world with the Fuhrer and his capitalist order, you know, I.G. Farben over there in Germany. And there's a reason for that. Just like we started off before, in the beginning, with Henry wanting behavior, basically modification programs set out on his workplace, the corporate media and the ruling savages in this country are just following in the same goose steps.
Another example of what Tracy is talking about in terms of the internationalization of reactionary ideology, in which the United States played a central role. As you know, as he just pointed out, white supremacy and racism were to a large extent refined and developed in the United States. Well, where was this madness and sickness taken to? Well, actually all corners of the earth, but also South Africa. Very deliberately, the National Party, which just met its timely demise, that is, it voted itself out of existence in South Africa just recently, they were the progenitors of apartheid. And they very openly stated that they saw the system of segregation in the United States as what they wanted to achieve in South Africa. So there is a, you know, this cross-fertilization of reactionary ideology internationally.
Hold on a sec.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe. Believe.
right, as we're heading to the home stretch, we're about to go into a Ruins of Empire segment that deals with the fantasies of the ruling class and their way of operation. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I did a segment on how Bill O'Reilly would make up stories, you know, like his combat record. You know, all he had was a pen in his hand, but he kept saying, you know, he was in combat. And then, over the air. And then a guy called him on it. And he admitted that, you know, he never was picking up the gun for nothing. It was all, you know, make-believe. He was just a reporter. But then, on another show, after he gets blown out of the water, he turns around and says it again, exposing the whole power relationship that those in the corporate media have and see themselves, where the truth doesn't really matter as long as they're not being called on it in a way that rips them out of their position for good. They're going to keep mythologizing the record. Now, most people know about the report that came out. You know, Newsweek did a little article where basically they had said an issue about the Koran being flushed down the toilet. And what ended up happening was the individual within the power structure of the state, you know, someone in the Pentagon within the White House structure who gave this information as a source to Ishakoff, Mike Ishakoff, the writer for Newsweek, basically was probably told, all right, retract that statement. He said that he told Ishakoff that he could no longer confirm it. So Ishakoff and Newsweek shamelessly pulled that issue, and the administration used that as an excuse of trying to discredit the whole thing, even though since that time the FBI and others had done reports, Amnesty International, etc., had done reports on the issue of how the Quran was treated in various ways, etc. Now, we're going to go into a quick thing about the relationship of power and the truth once again. Now, this deals with White House spokesperson Scott McCullen, who last week, speaking in regard to the Newsweek article in the Quran and what he claims was a result of that writing in the Newsweek article. So check this out.
You said that the retraction by Newsweek magazine of its story is a good first step. What else does the president want this American magazine to do?
Well, it's what I talked about yesterday. This report, which Newsweek has now retracted and said was wrong, has had serious consequences. People did lose their lives. The image of the United States abroad has been damaged. There is lasting damage to our image because of this report. And we would encourage Newsweek to do all that they can to help repair the damage that has been done, particularly in the region. And I think Newsweek can do that by talking about the way they got this wrong and pointing out what the policies and practices of the United States military are when it comes to the handling of the Holy Quran. The military put in place policies and procedures to make sure that the Quran was handled or is handled with the utmost care and respect. And I think it would help to point that out because some have taken this report, those that are opposed to the United States, some have taken this report and exploited it and used it to incite violence.
Well, with respect, who made you the editor of Newsweek? Do you think it's appropriate for you at that podium, speaking with the authority of the President of the United States, to tell an American magazine what they should print?
I'm not telling them. I'm saying that we would encourage them to help.
Pressuring them.
No, I'm saying we would encourage them.
Pressure?
Look, this report caused serious damage to the image of the United States abroad. And Newsweek has said that they got it wrong. You know, I think Newsweek recognizes the responsibility they have. We appreciate the step that they took by retracting the story. Now we would encourage them to move forward and do all that they can to help repair the damage that has been done by this report. And that's all I'm saying. But no, you're absolutely right. It's not my position to get into telling people what they can and cannot report.
So here you see Scott McCullen intentionally blocking or blocking reality out of his way and trying and implying, saying that the Newsweek article was what caused the deaths in Afghanistan. That was what fomented the riot and stuff. Now, when he's questioned and challenged, he shucks and jives and all of that type of stuff. But this is his statement on it. And he goes on about it had serious consequences and people lost their lives. This is what he's saying. So here, these guys, it's almost as if all of these issues, tortures, beatings, shootings, massacres all around the region just didn't occur. McCullen and the administration are shamelessly, this can only happen in a society that is in a very bad state. I'm talking mentally in a very bad state. When spokesmen for and administrators for the ruling class can throw out garbage like this and actually get some traction and not be hung up, something is seriously off kilter.
Well, you know, it's worse than off kilter, because simply the argument that, all right, that's what caused problems in Afghanistan. Do you know what? Just let's look at the real world. To buy a copy of Newsweek costs about $3, I guess, eh? Do you know how many Afghanis really read Newsweek? The number approaches zero. It's ridiculous. But here's the ugly side of it. And this is where you wonder how this fool could go around saying stuff like this. This week. Tracy, do you remember what date he actually made that comment?
Well, he said that last week. This is what he said basically this week.
Karzai was quite definite in saying that he didn't believe that the violence in Afghanistan was directly tied to the Newsweek article about Quran desecration. And from this podium, you have made that link, so...
Actually, I don't think you're actually characterizing what was said accurately. Now, as I said last week, and as President Karzai said today, as General Myers had said previously, the protests may well have been pre-staged. Discredited report was damaging. It was used to incite violence. But those who espouse an ideology of hatred and oppression and murder don't need an excuse to incite violence. But the reports from the region showed how this story was used to incite violence.
Seems to think that wasn't what led to the violence.
That's right. He actually talked about, President Karzai spoke about how the demonstrations were aimed at undercutting the progress being made toward democracy in Afghanistan and the progress on elections. They have elections coming up soon, and I spoke about that as well last week.
Could it be said that the Newsweek article played a role but was not...
John, I think we've made our views known when it comes to the discredited report. There are some that want to continue to defend what is a discredited report that has been disavowed by Newsweek, and that's their business. We're perfectly willing to trust the American people to make their own judgment about it.
Yeah, right. Look.
So you have a situation where, this is why I don't get into these word games about what's worse than off-kilter or whatever. It's obvious that this society is warped. And the fact that here you can have McCullen come back the very next week and change his story and now say and imply that it wasn't what caused the killings per se, that now they believe it was, or what he said was that it was pre-staged. Wow. So the shape shifted back. And not have the reporters, because basically they're in cahoots, to say, all right, stop it right there. Hey, one of you guys, you got to have the recording of what he said last week. Let's replay this back right now. And if you try to deny what you said last week, we're going to just take you out. but of course, it doesn't work like that. Because there's a partnership going on.
That's right.
And that form of warp partnership is something that exposes, just like Bill O'Reilly, the wickedness of what's going on. Now, to wrap this up, though, we have a situation where...
Hold on, Trace, just one thing. People should note, I scan and read the Times every day, so people should just... All week, they've had articles about what the United States Army had done, misusing the Quran in front of prisoners in order to provoke them. They have admitted as much. So this is not our personal opinion.
Well, this is a technicality game that the administration has allowed to pay in cahoots with large segments of the corporate media, because now if the issue is flushing a little Quran down the toilet as opposed to quote-unquote mishandling it. Since Newsweek, quote-unquote, retracted just specifically the statement that they can no longer verify from this particular source, the administration is using that. Now, of course, McCullen should have been attacked by, oh, what about what the FBI report said? What about this? I mean, this stuff has been coming out, what they've been doing to the little Quran and all of that type of stuff for years. This is nothing new. And they've been desecrating human beings. Yeah, so, I mean, that's what their imperialist war is all about. But another form of desecration is going on. And that is, people know I've been talking about the Sudan continuously from time to time on various slave revolt shows. And the Amnesty Secretary General, Irene Khan, says that... the Sudan has seen and been under the worst human rights cases over the last year. The Sudan, not Iraq, not Palestine, but the Sudan. This is what she says.
In 2004, the most publicized case of inaction was Darfur. The government of Sudan betrayed the rights of its own people by launching a campaign of rape, killings, destruction, and displacement. But the UN also betrayed them by doing too little, too late. The people of Darfur were held hostage to China's oil interests, to Russia's arms trade, and to the US's aversion to the International Criminal Court.
So there you have it in a little quick nutshell. Basically, China is in cooperation with the NIF, National Islamic Front, the genocidal regime that seized power in 1989. So they're in collaboration with them because they want the oil. Russia is making bucks off the arms trade. And Sam, as I talked about a few weeks ago, is coordinating and has been coordinating with the regime concerning this so-called war on terrorism. So the Sudanese regime is in collaboration with SAM and its global network of terrorism, imperial terrorism in the name of fighting terrorism. So the Sudan has its disposable people, the black people of Darfur. And in the past, the Southerners, they had the Bajas and others that they're exterminating in concentration camps, literally, right now. And Sam has been cock-blocking any type of things that would call for any kind of resolution. I'm talking their form of quote-unquote resolution to take place. So you have a situation where the International Criminal Court has been helped up because the United States itself does not want to see its partners in Darfur, the Arab government, as they see themselves, held accountable And as we've seen in Henry Ford and the Jews, those who are within that type of ideology are within cahoots with plundering the disposable people throughout the world. So you have a situation where the U.S. is blocked, China's in collaboration for oil, Russia's in collaboration for making money and arms, and once again, a genocidal issue is taking place in the name of expanding imperial power. That's what happens when privatized states in cahoots with themselves line up to basically crush the masses of people. If you're not on the side of the masses of black people in Darfur, you're no different than some Zionist in Israel, regardless of what you think of your little Quran or Christian Bible or Torah or any of that other invisible man, invisible kingdom, yada 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 nonsense. Hold on a second. I'll wrap it up for Slave tonight. It's clear that as long as we allow these fools to maintain power, instead of realizing the power of our own class interest, the power of our soul, and the power of our own intellect, we'll be crushed into the ground. That's not what's going to happen in the end. Until the next time, Slave Revolt. Out. Thank you.